Okay, thank you so much, and thanks for inviting me to be here and give this talk. So what I want to present here is, let's say, some recent advances in the quantization of symmetry reduced models using loop quantum gravity techniques. So I want to focus on some recent advances that has been done so far in the last year, and then I want to discuss properties of the effective geometries that we can compute with these quantum theories, and then analyze the kind of modification that we should expect in the semi-classical physics, for instance, when we jump from quantum field theories in coarse spacetimes to quantum field theories in quantum geometry. So I think it's not going to be very difficult to convince the audience that general relativity is not a fundamental theory. And the reason is that, obviously, if matter is quantum, there is some tension between, you know, Einstein theory, where geometry is treated classically while matter is treated quantum mechanically, but also because there are some singularity theorems that are telling us that in general relativity, under very general circumstances, there could be singularities where the theory will lose predictability. So we should look for an extension of general relativity in the high curvature regimes. So whatever this extension is, although I will focus here in loop quantum gravity, or let's say loop quantum cosmology extended to inhomogeneous models, whatever the theory we choose should be able to answer several questions. For instance, what is the nature of the space-time close to the high curvature regions? Can any of these candidates solve the singularities, all of them, or if not all, some? How is going to do the theory this? What are the kind of observables that we should be able to access that are going to tell us additional information about how this quantum extension or how these theories are going to extend general relativity? And of course, since sometimes these theories are more complicated than general relativity, and we know that it's very difficult to deal with general relativity itself, if it is possible to build models that are able to capture reliable information about these theories, about these extensions that can be confronted with observations, finally to even rule out not only the models, but hopefully even the full theory. So I will start with let's say an introduction to what has been done. Then I will go through some more technical details. So this is going to be more or less half of the talk. And then at the end, I will focus on something more interesting, like how to deal with quantum field theories on quantum geometries and how to extract predictions. I will explain a little bit about this effective field quantum field theories in the context of black holes, and then more details about cosmological perturbation theory in Bianchi 1 spacetimes. So, as I mentioned before, if we want to do predictions with the theory, in this case, in the following, I will focus on loop quantum gravity, we should be able to give some initial data, right, on physically interesting situations, for instance, the ones that I am mentioning here, Freeman-Robertson-Walker or Bianchi 1 cosmologies, or black hole spacetimes, sparse geometries, Kerr geometries, etc. I will not talk about anything related with Kerr geometries, but I will do it about sparse. So we should be able to define some initial data and do evolution. In general relativity, we know how to do this numerically, right? But for instance, in loop quantum gravity, we don't know at the moment how to do this evolution. So this is why we should be able to derive models. There has been a lot of effort in order to derive more reliable models from the full theory. There is this program, for instance, of quantum reduced loop gravity or group field theories, where there are some Bose-Einstein condensates that mimic cosmological models. Here, instead, I will focus on the quantization using loop quantum gravity techniques of symmetry reduced models of the classical theory. Freeman-Robertson-Walker, Bianchi cosmologies, or black hole spacetimes. So why? Essentially because, first of all, we have been able to learn many, many valuable lessons from these models. For instance, related with how to solve the quantum dynamics, identify semi-classical sectors, and even learn some new physics and mathematical properties that we hope they are going to be useful in the full theory. So I think this is why it's so important, and eventually maybe these models will allow us to define or provide predictions that eventually will be able, we will be able to compare with observations. The model that has been studied in more details in Loose Quantum Cosmology is a flat frame of Robertson-Walker spacetime coupled to a massless scalar field, a minimally coupled scalar field. So here, if you choose the scalar field as a physical clock, you can consider a state that is peaked on some semi-classical state in the future, and then you can do evolution back in time. And then you will see that the state will never hit the singularity, but still, instead, this state will bounce due to the quantum geometry corrections that appear at high curvature regimes or high energy density regimes. So we know very well how to solve the quantum dynamics. We understand very well singularity resolution in these geometries. And also we know how to classify some of the semi-classical sectors of the theory, and out of them derive effective dynamics that everybody can understand. For instance, here you have the modified Friedmann equation, where you get additional corrections coming from quantum geometry that essentially are telling you that whenever the energy density reaches the critical energy density, that is about of the order of the Planck energy density, quantum gravity effects makes gravity repulsive in an effective way, and then the bounce occurs and singularity resolution appears. So the quantum dynamics has been also analyzed in several models within this context. For instance, Friedmann-Robertson-Walker spacetime with closed topology, with positive and negative cosmological constant, with different matter content, like for instance, in relativistic fluids, and even in cosmologic anisotropic cosmological models, for instance, Bianchi 1 spacetimes. Here I want to focus or spend some time discussing some interesting results that were published several years ago by Martín Benito, Mena Maruán, and Pawlowski about the quantization of Bianchi anisotropic models, because they are going to be relevant for the discussion of the technical details I want to discuss later. So here the interesting thing I want to emphasize is that whenever you define the Hamiltonian evolution, you have to choose a physical clock, an internal variable in the system that plays the role of clock. You can choose a clock that is globally well-defined. It's a monotonous function in the whole phase space, and therefore the evolution is well-defined globally. And this is the sample that you can see here when you plot the evolution of the different scale factors with time. And here the time essentially is one of the conjugate variables to these scale factors. But instead, you can use, for instance, one of the scale factors as a time, as a clock. However, the clock is not well defined because it's not monotonous. There is a bounce. So therefore, you have to do a local evolution. Essentially, what you have to do is define the evolution in different charts where the corresponding clock is a monotonous function. And this is what you see here. I don't know if you see well the color, but there are some green expectation values with the corresponding dispersions. And here you have the other patch of the evolution where you can see also expectation values and dispersion relations. So what you should expect is that obviously this evolution will be well defined away from the point where the clock is ill-defined, but close to where the clock is bouncing, something funny is going to happen, right? So this is the only thing I want to mention about these results. And finally, just conclude this part of the introduction by saying that other cosmological models with anisotropies, like this kind of Bianchi spacetimes, and also Kantosky-Sachs cosmology that are relevant for black hole physics, they have been also studied, but only in the context of effective dynamics, not the full quantum dynamics. So now what happens, this is everything for homogeneous models. Now what happens if we go to inhomogeneous models, like for instance, black hole spacetimes in vacuum, or with some matter content, or polarized Gaudi models that are essentially cosmological models, Bianchi 1 cosmological model, so depending on what is the topology that you choose, with some gravitation, non-perturbative gravitational waves propagating in one direction of inhomogeneity. This is somehow the equivalent of the Einstein-Rosen gravitational waves. So in the context of spherically symmetric space-time and Gaudian cosmologies in Loose Quantum Cosmology, we know how to reduce the theory. There are several papers where they explain how to do this and how to build a kinematical Hilbert space in the loop representation that is well adapted to these symmetry reduced models. And on it, you can represent, for instance, the Hamiltonian constraint following the ideas by Thomas Thiemann. However, these proposals are just formal, because even when you have a well-defined quantum operator, we don't know if this constraint has a consistent algebra at the quantum level. We don't know how to solve or how to derive the solutions of these Hamiltonian constraints. So the quantization is formal. We don't know what could we do with this at the moment. But there has been another proposal in the last years, like 10 years ago, by again Martin Mena, Marugana, and also Garay, where they proposed for Gaudi cosmologies this so-called hybrid quantization. So here the strategy is the following. You start with a reduced theory, but you implement a partial gauge fixing. So you are left at the end of the day with two homogeneous constraints, one scalar constraint and one Diffeo constraint. So since they are homogeneous, there is no problem with the algebra. So you can now Fourier span the fields that you are left and implement or adopt a hybrid quantization where you mix the loop representation for the homogeneous degrees of freedom with a Fock representation for the inhomogeneities. This is the idea of the hybrid quantization. You can also build a robust kinematic algebra space for this description and also even provide the solutions to the constraints. But the construction again is formal because nobody has understood or solved the quantum dynamics or identified semi-classical sectors, derived any effective dynamics from the full quantum dynamics. So something that one could do in this quantization, for instance, is analyze the dynamics from the effective point of view. But recently, in the last years, we were very lucky that Gambini and Poulin, in the context of spherically symmetric vacuum spacetime, they proposed an idea on how to deal with the quantization of the models. And the idea basically consists in carry out an abelianization of the scalar constraint. So you have the axion, the reduced Hamiltonian of the theory, that is a combination of two constraints, the scalar constraint and one Diffeo constraint in the direction of inhomogeneity. Then you go to a new Hamiltonian where you redefine the Laplace and the shift function in such a way that the new Hamiltonian that you get, the new scalar constraint, that is a linear combination of the old or the original scalar and Diffeo constraint, is such that it has an algebra that is it commutes with itself. So it's a Lie algebra. And with this Lie algebra of these new constraints, it's very easy to quantize the theory and then analyze the dynamics. So let me mention that this strategy can also be applied to Gaudi cosmologies with local rotational symmetry. So essentially you identify two of the axes to be identical. And also you can apply this kind of techniques to dilatonic black holes that are essentially 1+1 field theories.
Happy, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Transformation is totally non-trivial and non-obvious, but it's clear why it's possible, in my mind, it should be due to symmetry. So is there some way to understand that change as relating to the symmetry? Are you choosing a foliation that's nice? Are you doing something that makes the Hamiltonian constraint nice?
Essentially, I think the reason why you can do this is because of the symmetry, because you only have one direction of inhomogeneity. And it seems for all these models, even if you couple matter, even in that case, you have an abelian constraint. And regarding the foliation, you have to be careful because the foliation, if you choose one that is homogeneous, this term is zero and the transformation is singular. So homogeneous slicings are not allowed in this quantization. But you have all the others. All the inhomogeneous slicing that you want are in principle valid.
And do you have any intuition about how to find this?
No. I mean, this is something that I think Gambini and Poulin realized when they study a partial gauge fixing. So they essentially introduce a gauge fixing when you get rid of the Diffeo constraint and you have a new Hamiltonian constraint. This Hamiltonian constraint is abelian, right? And essentially, I think they were able to somehow identify that in the Hamiltonian constraint, in the original one, there is a contribution that is linear in one of the momenta and that you can solve essentially using the Diffeo constraint. And that is somehow the idea I think was behind. But otherwise, more fundamental reason, I don't know. So now, with this classical theory, you can adopt again the kinematical Hilbert space proposed by Bojowal and Swiderski. Essentially, the basic building blocks in the quantization are the so-called one-dimensional spin networks. So they are graphs that are formed by just combination of holonomies in the radial direction that we identify with edges, and these edges, they have some valence, kj. J represents the corresponding edge in the spin network. And this guy is essentially the eigenvalue of the conjugate variable of the connection inside the holonomy, and it can be interpreted as the corresponding area of the conjugate variable, or essentially the eigenvalue of the conjugate variable that are nothing but the areas, for instance, in this case, of the Killing orbits. There are also another point holonomies in these spin networks that we identify with vertices in the spin network. And the valences, mu, correspond also to the eigenvalues of the conjugate variables. That also they have some physical interpretation. Finally, in this kinematical Hilbert space, we have a well-defined inner product. Here, all these deltas are Kronecker deltas, so they are indicating that the geometry is intrinsically discrete. And then on this kinematical Hilbert space, you can represent the scalar constraint, for instance, as a well-defined operator. You also know what are the transformations that these operators, both the Diffeo constraint and the scalar constraint, generate. And using the group averaging technique, you can find the physical Hilbert space. On this physical Hilbert space, we have well-defined Dirac observables. For instance, in the case of spherically symmetric spacetimes, the mass of the black hole is a one global degree of freedom. In the case of Gaudi cosmology with local rotational symmetry, correspond to the densitized CR scalar. This is another degree of freedom in the classical theory. But in addition, there are new quantum Dirac observables that they don't have a classical Dirac analog, but they have a classical interpretation. They are the areas of the Killing orbits. For instance, in spherically symmetric spacetimes, is the areas of the spheres of symmetry. So now what do we do with this quantization? We can compute FFT geometries, for instance. And then I will explain how to do this, or how can we do this at the moment. In the case of spherically symmetric spacetimes, the idea is to represent the components of the metric as parametrized observables. And the idea behind is the components of the metric, they are not Diffeo invariant, but they are covariant. But if you write the components of the metric in a particular gauge, in a particular system of coordinates, there you can identify which quantities are observables and which quantities are parameters or coordinates. Then you do that, and then you just promote the corresponding quantities to suitable Dirac observables that are parametrized because they depend on parameters. And if they have a well-defined action on the physical Hilbert space, that's it. Then you define the corresponding line element. For instance, here I am giving the line element in some coordinates that are the so-called spatially flat gauge fixing. They are horizon penetrating, so I can prove with these geometries the interior of the black hole. And here you have a concrete example. So what are the properties of these effective geometries? First of all, they are discrete. So they are piecewise constant in the radial direction. Second, they are regular, close to the singularity will be region. So the metric never becomes degenerated. However, there are many properties that we don't understand. For instance, how to build a suitable curvature operator in these discrete geometries, check whether the curvature scalars, they are bounded in the high curvature region, if these bounds are universal or not, whether these geometries are stable, how would be possible to extend the geometries beyond these high curvature regions, or even analyze the interplay between the horizon of this geometry, that you can more or less guess what is going to happen from this term here, and the interplay between this horizon and the geometry when both of them are fluctuating. So these are very interesting questions that we haven't understood or we haven't studied in detail yet.
Just a quick question. Does the signature comes out naturally, or signature of this?
Oh, it comes naturally whenever you start with this parametrized observable from the classical description.
Okay.
That is one of the assumptions that you have to do in order to use this parameterized observable. So you start with the classical theory and then you promote this to a quantum operator. So all these ideas, they can be applied to Gaudi cosmology with local rotational symmetry. All the things that I have explained for effective geometries. And also you can conclude in a paper that I did with my collaborators Martin de Blas and Pawlowski, that actually you get discrete geometries that are also singularity free in the sense that I have explained before, and so on and so forth. However, we were not very happy with the description of parameterized observables, because at some point, the crucial problem is that you have to use information from the classical theory. And you don't want to use information from the classical theory when you are in the quantum framework. What you want to do is, out of the quantum framework, somehow find what are the sectors that allow you to recover the classical theory. So somehow there is some tension. And we wanted to provide some more reliable description using or defining a Hamiltonian evolution. With this Hamiltonian evolution, in principle, we should be able to compute effective geometries. This is not a big problem, because I have proof in another of my papers that actually, if you apply this parameterized observables technique, or you define a Hamiltonian evolution, in very simple systems, like, for instance, the parameterized free particle, that is just a simple model with one physical degree of freedom, you can prove that the two descriptions are equivalent. They are just nothing but a description in terms of the Heisenberg picture or the Schrödinger picture. Okay, so there is a very nice explanation. But whenever you apply a polymer quantization, this is not so obvious. So the way that we provide this Hamiltonian evolution is as follows. You start with a physical Hilbert space, okay? Then you have to identify a physical clock, a phase space variable that is going to play the role of time. And in order to have a well-defined time, usually you have to make sure that this quantity doesn't commute with the constraint, with the scalar constraint. Because if it commutes with the constraint, you are choosing a Dirac observable as a time, and you don't want to do that. Okay? So once you have this clock, then you define a set of a family of unitary transformations in the sense that they are norm preserving. That means essentially that you can map states from the physical Hilbert space to some auxiliary Hilbert space that can be parameterized by this time function. And in this model, for instance, we can choose a local time function, because we have one clock per vertex of the spin network. And finally, once you have these transformations, if you have to identify suitable operators that are well-defined in these auxiliary Hilbert spaces, and then with it, you can just define the whole evolution using or combining these maps. So here I will show you an example on how to do this very quickly, and then I will conclude with this part that is the most boring part of the talk, okay? And then I will jump to something more interesting, I guess. So you take the solutions to the constraint in the representation of the time that you are going to choose. And then from the properties of the corresponding function that appear in the solution, you can guess whether the function is monotonic or not. In our case, we realize that the function that we are choosing as a time is not monotonic. But the nice thing is that it is monotonic in two portions of the evolution. So we split those portions using a kind of projection and a couple of Fourier transforms. With this splitting, we can define the corresponding unitary maps P that I defined before in this way. And out of them, you can compute the unitary evolution operators. And then you go and you consider superpositions of these guys, such that you make sure that at the end of the day, the norm of this state is, if you can, it is constant, time independent, and it agrees with the physical norm. So at the end of the day, when you define evolution, the crucial point is that you don't lose information from the original state that you consider in your physical Hilbert space to these auxiliary Hilbert spaces that define the evolution. And finally, you can define Dirac observables in the usual way as it is done in the Schrödinger representation. So the merits of this description is that you can implement a rigorous Hamiltonian evolution that is going to be local, but at least we don't have to rely in any classical expression. We don't have to use this kind of parameterized observables anymore. What are the limitations? For instance, on each of the portions of the evolution where we have split or we have divided the time, the corresponding states are not solutions to the original constraint, but we can relate them with those without problems. So this is not a big deal. Another problem is that obviously something weird is going to happen where the evolution is not well defined. For instance, you lose in physical interpretation of the Dirac observables at the regions where the time is, again, ill-defined. And also, we don't know yet how to extend these ideas when you have a phase space variable that has several bounces and recollapses. For instance, in a Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetime with closed topology, where the volume bounces and recollapses several times. And I think this is going to be necessary in order to be able to extend this Hamiltonian evolution to spherically symmetric spacetime, black hole spacetime. Okay, so that's it. Now I want to discuss quantum field theories on these quantum geometries. So once we have an effective geometry coming from these quantum theories, something that we could do is just define a field theory, for instance, a massive scalar field minimally coupled to the geometry on these effective geometries. This is a possibility. But I think there is a more fundamental way of doing it that is instead using information from the dynamics of the field itself. So you start with the classical axiom, right? This is the standard classical axiom of a massive scalar field. You have here a coupling with the geometry. Now you promote these geometrical operators to quantum geometrical quantities to these parameterized observables that are quantum operators. And then you just compute the expectation values using some background state. And from here, you are going to get some effective geometry. I will show you an example in the next slide. So many interesting properties that you can analyze with these effective geometries now is what is the role of discrete geometry and quantum anisotropies and the CMB? What are the modifications that you can expect in Hawking radiation or even the spectrum of quasi-normal modes in these black hole spacetimes? So here there is one particular example that I want to show you what are the kind of modifications that you can get due to quantum fluctuations of the geometry. This is the Hamiltonian of a scalar field, a massive scalar field, on a spherically symmetric spacetime. We promote the geometrical quantities to operators, compute expectation values. And those expectation values, once you expand the field in spherical harmonics, in this spherically symmetric spacetime, are given by this piece, okay? So these pieces are just essentially the expectation values of all these quantities that you can see here. Now, out of these quantities, you can derive what is the so-called effective geometry that in the following I will refer it as the Dressed geometry because this was something that was originally proposed by Abai, Agullo, Astekar, Agullo, and Nelson in the context of quantum cosmology. And then here is you can write the components of this Dressed metric in terms of the previous expectation values. So something interesting that you can see is that if you start with a scalar field with a constant mass, that is this guy here, the quantum fluctuations of the geometry gives you a dressed mass that now is not constant anymore. It depends on the coordinate, on the radial coordinate. Obviously, whenever quantum fluctuations are zero, you consider a state that is sharply peaked, this guy here goes to one, and then you recover the usual description. But if there are quantum fluctuations of the geometry, then some funny things can happen. And this is what I had to say about the spherically symmetric spacetime. Now I want to move to another example, cosmological perturbation theory in Bianchi 1 spacetimes. This is some work that I am doing in collaboration with Ivan Agullo and Srinath Vijayakumar. And essentially what we want to analyze is what happens when we go beyond Friedman-Robertson-Walker spacetimes. In principle, one should not expect nothing interesting because, I mean, at the moment, the present model that we consider and the observations are telling us that our universe is very isotropic. And if we use inflationary scenarios in order to describe the evolution of the universe from the early times until today, essentially inflation erases all contribution for anisotropies, inhomogeneities, and also curvature contributions. But this is not the end of the story, as you will see, and I will try to convince you. So at this moment, what I'm going to consider is Bianchi 1 spacetimes. So I will break the condition of isotropy but I will keep homogeneity and flatness. So cosmological perturbation theory in Bianchi 1 spacetime was provided like 10 years ago by Pereira, Pitru, and Usan. So they essentially provided a rigorous formulation in terms of gauge invariant perturbations, using a Lagrangian formalism and also adopting a scalar vector tensor decomposition. This decomposition is not completely reliable in the sense that the scalar vector tensor decomposition requires that you have rotational symmetry. And if you have an isotropic spacetime, this symmetry is broken. It's not valid anymore. But whenever you have some regions in your evolution where where your universe is isotropic, there in those regions you can do this decomposition. And this is what will happen in loop quantum cosmology, as I will just show you in few slides. So what is the interesting thing? That now scalar and tensor perturbations are coupled. So anisotropies will generate cross correlations between scalar and tensor perturbations. Anisotropies, they don't add or they don't induce dipoles in the power spectrum, but they break scale invariants and the isotropy of the power spectrum. And as I mentioned, they introduce cross correlations. So questions that and things that we implemented or we did in our work is first a derivation of the gauge invariant perturbation using a Hamiltonian formalism instead of the Lagrangian one. This is physically is not interesting because there is nothing new in the physics. But something that is very interesting, in my opinion, is that we also provided an exact fault quantization for the perturbations without assuming that the anisotropies have to be small. Another thing that we do is extending these results into the Planck regime, where using loop quantum cosmology. And also we find upper bounds in the anisotropies, the primordial quantum anisotropies of the spacetime, using the observational data. And also we characterize the cross correlations. This is, I think, the most interesting results among all of them. So let me just briefly summarize the properties of a Bianchi 1 spacetime in the classical theory, and then perturbations, and then I will go to loop quantum cosmology. So Bianchi 1 spacetime, they are characterized by three scale factors. The metric, you can write it in this diagonal form. We are going to couple a massive scalar field, minimal coupling, okay? Then, if you introduce this average scale factor, A, and the corresponding Hubble parameter of this average scale factor, you can write the equation of motion in a very familiar way. These are the typical equations that you see in Freeman-Robertson-Walker spacetimes for the average scale factor. But now, since you have some contribution of the anisotropies, you have a contribution of the CR right here. And this CR, thanks to this equation of motion, you can prove that it only depends on some constants of integration, some Dirac observables, and the average scale factor. So once you provide information of these Dirac observables, then you can integrate this set of equations as you do in Freeman-Robertson-Walker spacetimes. And here you have an example of the typical trajectory that you can get, or that I am going to consider in this talk. Here I am plotting the right hand side of the Freeman equation, the kinetic energy density of the scalar field, the potential energy density, and the contribution of the shear. So the red line is the kinetic energy density that dominates at early times. Then below you have the contribution of the anisotropies, and then the potential energy density. You see that at some point, since this guy decreases when you move to the future, the potential energy density dominates, and then inflation begins somewhere here, and then you have the slow roll regime. So you have a nearly exponential expansion of the universe. There, the universe isotropizes very fast, and then you see that the CR decreases very quickly. So this is the typical situation that I'm going to consider. And of course, in general relativity, the CR and the kinetic energy density, they blow up at the singularity. So for the perturbations, you can follow a gauge invariant formulation for the perturbations. And here is the Hamiltonian that is quadratic. You can identify here the scalar Mujano-Sasaki variables, and here the tensor Mujano-Sasaki variables. The things that are in blue are the new modifications that you get in these Bianchi 1 spacetimes. In particular, the comoving wave number now is time dependent. It's Freeman, Roberts, and Walker, this guy is independent of time. And in addition, you get some couplings between scalar and tensor perturbations, and between tensor and tensor perturbation with different polarizations. So everything is coupled here. And in addition, you get some additional contribution in the typical functions that you have here and here in the diagonal terms that also includes some contribution from the shear. Especially, as you can see, the time-dependent function, the diagonal part of the tensor perturbations. So you just take all the blue things here that are proportional to the shear and you just set them equal to zero, then you get Freeman, Roberts, and Walker spaces. So from this Hamiltonian, you can derive linear equation of motion for the perturbations. I insist that these perturbations are going to be coupled all together. But even when they are coupled, it is possible, thanks to the fact that the theory is linear, or the equation of motion are linear, you can define a Fock quantization for the perturbations. And the idea is very simple. You realize that each solution to the equation of motion will have three entries, right? The scalar entry and the two tensor entries. And also you have the time derivatives. Now, any general solution, since this superposition principle applies here, recall that the theory is linear, can be written as a linear combination of solutions that are orthonormal. But they are orthonormal with respect to some inner product. We have a suitable inner product, the Klein-Gordon inner product of this linear field theory. And it is given by this condition here. So what happens is that now we have in this inner product three addends, where in the Freeman-Robertson-Walker spacetime, when you have isotropy, each of the addends is constant independently. But in the presence of an isotropy where everything is coupled, then you have to add the three of them for each solution in order to have an inner product that is preserved upon evolution. And you can check that it is constant. Just take the time derivative of this guy, use the equation of motion, and you will find that this quantity is constant. So now, if you just consider positive frequency solutions, that is, solutions that have a positive norm with respect to this inner product, you identify this coefficient with the annihilation variables and this one here with the creation variables, and then you can just promote them to quantum operators, and that's it. You can define your Fock quantization by just requiring that the backing state of the theory is annihilated by the annihilation operators for all possible modes of your theory. Okay, so this is for the quantization of the perturbations. Now, we are going to assume that those field equations are still valid when we replace the background, the classical Bianchi one background, by the loop effective description that was provided originally by Astekar and Wilson Ewing, and then further studied by Menamar One and Martin Benito and some other people. But here we are going to focus on the effective description, including a potential, because we want to have an inflationary expansion during some period of evolution. So this model, from the effective point of view, was analyzed by Gupta and Singh some years ago, and they saw that several quantities like the energy density of the matter content, the expansion of the universe, and the shear scalar, all of them, they have upper bounds in these geometries. Some of them, they are only going to be saturated whenever some conditions are given. For instance, you will saturate the energy density upper bound if you are in the isotropic case, when the shear is zero. And the opposite, if the energy content of the universe is zero, then you are going to have the maximum value of the shear. Okay? Otherwise, you will have a balance between them. And this is what you see here. This is the similar trajectory that I saw at the beginning, but when we include evolution starting from very early times, even before the high curvature region. Here what happens is that you have a collapsing universe that is here, then the energy density is growing, and also the anisotropies, they are growing. Then they reach a maximum value that is finite, and then they decrease again to the future, and you have some inflation starts somewhere here. So the interesting thing is that in these geometries, the shear is small in the past. So the universe is quite isotropic in that regime. and also after inflation. So the nice thing is that it is possible to give suitable or reliable initial data to the perturbations in this regime. For instance, I can choose the Minkowski vacuum state, the usual one that we choose in Freeman-Robertson-Walker spacetime. And the reason is that if I try to do the same here at the bounds, everything is coupled, right? And the anisotropies are large. So there are going to be very strong cross correlations, as it is not obvious how to justify the Minkowski vacuum state in that regime. But if you do it here, then at least it's something that you can do. And this is what we did. Ah, let me just show you that this is actually the case. This is the adiabatic conditions. This is just telling us what are the modes that are sub-Hubble before the bounds. During the bounds, many of them become super-Hubble for a very tiny amount of time, whenever the bounds happens. And then again after the bounds, they become sub-Hubble again. And then at the end, when they exit the horizon, during inflation or during a slow roll, they become super-Hubble again. And this corresponds to the wave numbers on the three principal directions of the spacetime. In fact, you have all the possible directions in the sky. But here I'm just considering the three principal directions just to show what is happening. And the same for the power spectrum. These are the results of our simulations. So here I am showing you the power spectrum of scalar perturbations in the three principal directions, when the universe is anisotropy. And this is what you see that I mentioned at the beginning. The isotropy of the power spectrum is broken. You see that it is different in different colors because they correspond to different directions of the space, in the sky. But still, you get a region where you have a nearly scale invariant power spectrum. So if you have a large enough number of EFOLs or a large expansion during the inflationary evolution, the observable window will move to the right, and then you are only going to see this region here. So as I will mention later, you can provide upper bounds to the shear or the spacetime to the anisotropies, but this upper bound will depend only on the number of EFOLs that you have. Okay? Same happens for the tensor perturbations. Here I am just plotting one of the polarizations. Again, the power spectrum, it depends on the direction that you are looking at. And this is, again, an effect due to the anisotropies.
And how does this compare to the non-LQC?
To the usual LQC calculations? Well,
the anisotropic Bianchi one, but not with LQC modifications.
Oh, how you can compare? Well, that is very difficult, actually. Because in Bianchi one spacetimes, in the classical theory, you have to give initial conditions before inflation. But the point is that before inflation, you have a spacetime that is anisotropic. So you have somehow to provide how to justify the choice of initial data for the perturbations. And besides, whenever you move close and closer to the singularity, less modes are sub-Hubble, so it is more difficult to give initial data to those modes. And in addition, the anisotropies are very large. Whenever you go closer to the, also everything gets correlated. So in general relativity, the papers by Pitreau and these guys, they say that it's not possible to provide reliable predictions because of this. Because you don't have a well-defined isotropic adiabatic region to give initial data to the perturbations. Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks. So, but what I think is more important, that is okay, because, I mean, the power spectrum can be anisotropy, but are you going to measure it? Maybe not, and if especially if you have a large number of EFOLs, what are you going to see? But the important thing is the following. Now I am showing you a comparison between the different diagonal correlation function for scalar and tensor perturbations and the cross correlations between scalar and tensor perturbation with the two polarizations and tensor perturbations with two polarizations. And here you see that these guys here are the corresponding diagonal power spectrum, but here you have the cross correlation, one of them. There are another two down here. This is very small, so we don't expect to see them. And this is only for one of the principal directions. So all these things will be modified if you move the directions when you are computing the power spectrum. But the important thing is that one of the correlation functions can be very large. Even for this region where the power spectrum is not the scale invariant, can be in between the amplitude of the or the magnitude of the scalar power spectrum and the tensor power spectrum. But in addition, the most interesting thing of all is that for the region where you have a scale invariant power spectrum, this the magnitude of this cross correlation is still not so small. Actually, for the largest wavelengths, it is close to the same magnitude of the tensor power spectrum. And this decays as 1 upon k here, where k is the corresponding wave number. So if we are able to measure tensor perturbations, it is not completely crazy that if there were a region of the space during the evolution of the spacetime that was anisotropic, cross correlations are just some few orders of magnitude below the magnitude of the tensor power spectrum. Okay? So this is the main message I want to deliver. And well, that's pretty much essentially what I wanted to say. Just to mention that it is possible to find upper bounds, that in order to do so, we define some estimator that is nothing but the relative difference between the power spectra in different directions. And you just choose some region of your power spectrum where you say, hey, here, I don't want to have a very anisotropic power spectrum. For instance, we select that the power spectrum is not very anisotropic at multiple angular momenta L equals 30. And then for the corresponding number of efforts that is determined by this guy here, the value of the scalar field at the bounds, we can compute different values of this estimator, increasing the value of the shear at the bounds, and then we see that at some point, this estimator will be equal to 1. So anisotropies larger than these values will not be allowed. But again, I insist, that bound depends on the number of efforts. If you change the number of efforts, these upper bounds also will change. Okay. So let me just conclude that we can apply loop quantum gravity techniques to symmetry radius model. We can learn many interesting fundamental questions about singularity resolution, semi-classical geometries, effective description. We now are able to deal with the full quantization of inhomogeneous cosmological and black hole spacetimes. We still need to understand a little bit better the dynamics, the semi-classical sector and the effective geometries of these models. But also, I think it's very promising because we can use these techniques to extend the traditional quantum field theories on curved spacetimes to these quantum geometries from the point of view of the resmetric description. In these particular models, it is not very well understood, so still there are many fundamental questions like what happens, how the discretization and the fluctuation of the geometry modify the usual predictions that we know in these scenarios in the classical theory. And I have shown also that a couple of applications, a little bit about spherically symmetric spacetimes, but mainly to cosmological anisotropic spacetimes in loop quantum cosmology, in the particular case of the Yankee 1. So we have provided a gauge invariant formulation using a canonical formalism. As I said at the beginning, this is physically not, there is no, we are not adding anything else physically from this treatment, but I think it's elegant from the point of view of people that work in canonical quantum gravity. But we provide an exact for quantization, regardless of what is the magnitude of the anisotropies. That is something that, as far as we know, nobody has done before. We compute also the power spectrum of the cross correlations. We characterize the cross correlations. As I mentioned, they are potentially observable. I hope that, I think it is more or less obvious, and although I haven't discussed it, that they are going to induce quantum entanglement if anisotropies are present in the CMB, and that it is possible to find upper bounds of the shear that depend on the number of efforts. Okay, that's it. Thank you so much. Questions?
She's been asking questions all day.
I was very late, but can you go back to the definition of your annihilation and creation operators with anisotropies? So your modes, as you say, it's just maybe I didn't have time to see it. No, but the Okay, you have modes, as you said, like a it's labeled by a vector because they are coupled. But then it's not that one there. Okay, and you say the theory is linear, we can quantize it, but this, okay, for every I you have still a vector.
Yes, yes.
So every annihilation and creation operator is on this triple.
Yes, exactly. So what I had to do.
The thing is that then you have a region where they might decouple. And that's
yes.
Where you give the initial condition.
Yes, exactly.
But I was simply wondering that, okay, these operators are in each triple, let's say.
Mm.
And we find.
Actually, they are related with each orthogonal solution for the equation of motion. So you give me one orthonormal solution, that defines one annihilation operator.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that orthonormal solution has three entries.
Exactly.
Right.
I
then you give me.
I thought when you were telling, I thought that you were splitting them.
No.
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 So. But they are couple and yeah. Okay.
So mm-hmm.
I have no question then.
Okay. Thank
okay.
you again.
Thank you.